Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thanks for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I'm Terry Foy, once again joined by Nick Osello, and we are talking about the most important question in all of college lacrosse. Nick, is Matt Moore underrated?
The fact that it's legitimately becoming a thing is just stupid.
It's not
like,
legitimately becoming a
Pennell
thing.
Pennell tweeted out, like, he's not one for humor on Twitter. He's just is out there saying stuff. And if Rob Pennell, a big-time player, is saying it, then it now is becoming a thing. And it's stupid, and I hate it.
I thought it was becoming a thing because we were all dunking on Rob Pennell for a bad take.
No, because Quint said it on the Syracuse game today. It was like Schellenberger. So, see, I'm just filled with hate today, Terry. Bear with me. But he was like, Sisselberger's so good. Like, does Matt Moore even get the credit that he deserves? And I was watching it with some guys, and we were all just like screaming at the TV, like, yes, of course he does. What are we doing here? So I think it's like, it's the fun thing where it's like, it only happens like twice in a month, but those two times I'm like, oh, you know, now it's big, way bigger than it is, because I'm focusing on negatives, because we record this on Sundays, not Fridays.
We are not actually here to talk about that. That game happened like 96 hours ago. It feels like the entire world has changed since then. We are here to talk about two pretty mediocre teams. Might be generous in some respects, but it's the most interesting thing to talk about coming away from this college lacrosse weekend. Dave Petromala made his return to Homewood Field as an assistant coach for the Syracuse Orange. They took on the Johns Hopkins Blue Jays and went back to Central New York with a 10-7 loss, thanks in large part to Josh Curson's 14 saves, Joey Epstein's 2 goals and 3 assists, Jonathan Peschko's 3 goals, Jack Keogh and Jacob Angelus, whose nickname is Angel, which is great, both went for 2-1. Garrett Degnan had 2 goals, and I thought a really crazy play when he took a shot in transition. The rebound fell in front of the goalie, whose name is Harrison Thompson, if my memory is serving me correctly. Nick Camo came in, picked up the rebound, and Degnan pushed him into the crease, which is something that feels like it should happen way more often, because he got called for going in and out of the crease, which is not allowed to be done if you're a defenseman, with the ball at least. And Hopkins got the ball back. I can't remember whether they scored in that possession or not. Tyler Dunn only went 5 of 17, which is an incredible stat, because I felt like Hopkins did much better at the faceoff X than that. And yeah, ultimately holding the Orange to just 7 goals, including, I believe, just 5 even strength goals, was incredible, and we got to talk about their defensive performance. But the storyline, the take, that's what we're here for. What did you think of Petro's return to Homewood Field?
I think Syracuse should be relegated to the MCLA. I think that that was a very difficult game to watch all around. It was like, you know that first time when you realize that your parents are humans and not superheroes, you know, because you just grow up and you're like, nothing could ever affect my parents. And then tax season comes around and you see them stressed about taxes for the first time ever. And you're like, oh my God, that's what this game felt like. I felt like watching my mom and dad like have a really tough tax season and going like, oh shit, this is kind of sad and depressing. So Syracuse dump, Hopkins dump, cancel both of these teams, relegate them. I thought I was going to be holding out hope for a Syracuse Final Four run. Their entire offense, my problem with this entire game was Syracuse is playing an offense that is, all right, we are going to be a one-on-one bashing our head against the wall until it works. And yes, you can only rely so much on Dordovic. But it's the same conversation we were having, I think, like week one or week two, where it was like, okay, you know, we're going to give them some time to figure out how to integrate the rest of the offense. There was no integration of the offense. The skip passes were over the goalie's head every single time. This Syracuse offense was pathetic. And yes, you can say that they hit the post a bunch, but the fact that this Hopkins defense, you made them look like, you know, world beaters. I don't know. I'm ready to cancel both of these teams. Yes, it was cool that Petro returns to Hopkins. Yes, it was cool about the pageantry. But as, you know, as someone who cares more about the quality of the product than the storylines underneath it, I was frustrated watching this game start to finish. Now, I assume you have a little bit more appreciation for the glorification of Petro returning, and it's this great game. What's your take on it?
That's a horrible assumption. I actually don't like those things either. I think that they tend to be overblown. I can understand the fact that, you know, he's an all-time great player there. He's an all-time great coach there. He was there for 19 seasons, I think, 18 and a half. I won two national championships as a coach. It's important. I'm not underselling that. I just think that there's this weird... It's not... The separation between the game on the field and the storylines off the field, both in terms of the way that the game is broadcast, and this isn't limited to lacrosse. This happens all the time. And then also in terms of, I don't know, the way that we think about analyzing it, oftentimes are not well enough separated. That being said, I'm going to do exactly what I just criticized, because I think that there's one thing that was not frequently brought up enough, if at all, because I didn't see this in the run-up to it, is that what it must have been like to be some of the guys. Everything was about like Petro's perspective. And it's funny that you use the word cool, because to me, like, you know, this was a guy that was nominally fired, you know, generally speaking, or specifically, I suppose, he just didn't have his contract renewed. But in the eyes of the audience, this was a guy that was fired. And so it was more about like the acrimony of returning. And they showed clips of him, you know, shaking Ernie LaRosa, the longtime SID's hand before the game and all that sort of stuff. So it clearly wasn't like bad feelings all around. Like, I think Petro is, you know, mature and intelligent enough to separate any type of acrimony, if there is some, and I don't know that there is, but if there is some, from the people who actually made the decision from those who didn't and were his colleagues for 20 years. But
fair.
Getting back to the original point, I don't think anybody thought or talked about this game in the context of the Hopkins players that he recruited. And there are a couple, specifically Connor DeSimone and Joey Epstein, who had incredibly close relationships with him. And Epstein played really well in the fourth quarter, but DeSimone and Epstein didn't play particularly well through the first three quarters. And, you know, I'm sympathetic to the fact that that probably wasn't the easiest game for them to play. And as a result, like, you know, I think about it in the context of sometimes the emotion of the game actually does affect you when you're a player. Also, just in terms of like putting a bow on this idea, thought that it was apropos that it wasn't the 10th goal. I believe it was the 9th goal. It was kind of the nail, so to speak, came from a Hopkins dodge, I believe, from Angelus. No, Angelus was the one who scored it. So I believe Epstein was the one who swam to his left, and he was fading. He was going away from the goal, and he drew a Syracuse slide and then moved it adjacent for an easy step down that, I think put Hopkins up 9-7 and proved to be the deciding goal in the game. And I was just like, the reason that's so apropos is because those are the types of goals that Hopkins defenses gave up way too frequently from 2016 to 2019 or 2020 that I think played an outsized role in the fact that Dave Petromala is no longer the head coach there.
Yeah, and the Jerry Byrne in me was just screaming, you know, and I even think Deemer Class called it out, where it was like, you know, he made a meme about not sliding from the crease, you know, hedging adjacent and leaving a guy open for a step down. I always call that biting the cheese when I'm coaching kids. Like, everybody was biting the cheese. It was like, oh, you know, a structured defense slides from the same place consistently over and over, generally speaking. This was like, okay, we know we're sliding from the crease, but ooh, this looks like a fun little double. And even though, you know, there were a million missed passes, nobody could, you know, Hopkins clear was a tragedy.
All right, so let me jump in there, because I want to go a little deeper on that.
I was going to make a great point, but now I'm not going to.
You can save it for your next podcast.
Good. So yeah, good.
I was talking to Dan Kaplan about this, my colleague at Inside Lacrosse, and he coached at York for a couple years. And he said that whenever they would go visit a Division I practice, they would ask the staff about their clear. And so frequently they were just like, I don't know, we just give the ball to the best athlete and he runs through everybody. And Kaplan's point is, well, we don't have the luxury of doing that because if we had that, if we had a guy on our team who was athletic enough to run through everybody, skilled enough or smart enough to play defense and skilled enough to carry the ball into the offensive end, he would be playing for you. And so as a result, we have to scheme our clear. So tell me about clearing at the Division I level.
It was my least favorite day. It was all of our least favorite day because Corrigan just drilled it into our head. This is what you're doing. We're going to do skeleton. We're going to do skeleton with fake defense. And then we're going to do live. And every single player was just like, Jesus Christ, can we just play 6-on-6? But I will say, like, I think our robust understanding of the ride and clearing game, and feel free to confirm or deny this, led to a much better execution of things like the 10-man ride. We had a relatively high clearing rate. It was never really a problem for Notre Dame. And I think the threshold that we had was because all of our defensemen could handle and catch the ball. You know, I know we've kind of talked about the woes of a military academy where you don't get to recruit the poles with the best angles. But it's very team by team dependent. Like Virginia, I would assume, has just had the punt return clear for years because they've had the stallions to do so. But, you know, people are almost moneyballing themselves. Like if I'm Notre Dame, and we'll talk about this in a second, you know, the one of the biggest parts about, you know, one of the bright lights of this season is that the Kavanaughs are the Kavanaughs and they do a great job riding and clearing. So, I mean, granted, yes, there's huge variance. Like we hammered it home and it was never a an issue for us. And I think that if you are a coach at the Division I level that is just resigning to the, oh, we'll give it to our best player and he'll clear it, you're probably 85 years old. You probably don't like the fact that there's color television. You don't like the fact that these dang automobiles are clogging up the road when a train or a horse-drawn carry, your buggy, works perfectly well. And you should probably put on a diaper and go to a retirement home because you're missing out on things that are going to win and lose you games.
Okay, so to build on that, two quick things. When you're struggling to get the ball over the midline and all three of your attackmen are within 5 yards of GLE, is that a good or a bad thing? Is that a good or a bad indicator of the clearing scheme that you've devised?
Generally speaking, bad. Because how many flop shots, sand wedge shots to the corner did we see?
I think like four.
Like four. And that's just so stupid. I just get so annoyed by that. And I think it's two things. One, you know, I don't know what their scheme for the midfielders was because it was always, you know, in the shit show of the defense's hands. But when the other team is just kind of piling by midfield and they're just running that like deep zone, that's the easiest thing in the world to pick apart. All that you need to do is have midfielders that can run and identify space and kind of have a defenseman throw, you know, a relatively fast pass and be able to handle it. So I'm very curious as to what wasn't clicking in Syracuse or in Hopkins' head where it was like, hey, midfielders, get the hell off. And the first midfielder, sprint to the far side. Doesn't matter. Draw the attention away from, you know, where everybody is. So we were debating on if it was, and when I say we, I was watching that game with a couple Seals guys. We were debating on if it was just like, holy shit, these Hopkins guys are out of shape, or if, oh my God, they literally forgot to work on writing and clearing for a full year. I don't know. I hated writing and clearing day. I hate seeing teams struggle with it because I think it gets in the way of what makes lacrosse entertaining, which is good 6-on-6, like genuinely pushing transition, not just having it be like, you know, bad clears. And again, I can't emphasize enough how bad of a game this was. It was just a bad game. Bad game all around. Riding, clearing, sixes, goaltending, defense, offense, faceoffs. It was all bad. I feel like an old grumpy man.
Before you move off of clearing, one more question. So if I'm a defenseman who doesn't want to try to split the double because I'm not confident in my own stick handling and the ball not coming out, the number of back checks and the number of trail checks in this game was unbelievable. Why don't I draw to have a midfielder step over the midline and just throw a 10-yard lob pass over the top to him?
Either the midfielders weren't letting them know, or, and this is like, it's a big distinction that you make, and when it finally clicks in your brain, not saying that Syracuse did a good job in this, but it really does change things. It's, you're not going for the turnover. You're just trying to make a defenseman who's uncomfortable with this ball on his stick make a panicked or rushed or over-assessed decision. So when these players are sprinting down, all the defenseman has to worry about is catching up to the guy. And we saw it time and time again. They have 5 yards of separation. And as they get closer to the decision, they're not really just saying, okay, I'm just going to wait to see who's drawn to me. I'm just going to move it to wherever that slide is coming from. They were going, okay, I'm going to slow down a little bit so that I can assess, is the point man open? Can I skip it? Should I get ready for a shot? And it just seemed like this is a big reason why I thought, like, every time there was a trail check, we'd all just start, like, booing and throwing shit at the TV. Because that's something that you need to have drilled into you, and that's something that you need to be expected to do at a high level of lacrosse. It's Cuse Hopkins. You're telling me you can't make an easy read in a fast break situation because there's a trailer on you? That's something that you're drilled to do 100 times in a row. When you work on fast breaks, in high school even, there's a trailer on you. So the lack of decision-making was bananas, and it led to what? There were probably like six that I can recall, just bad trail checks.
So a couple more things on this game, and then we're going to move on. The pace, the fact that Hopkins played slow offensively, felt like a good decision. Felt like it worked. Felt like it created the fatigue factor that they were trying for. I don't know. I mean, also the game wasn't that slow. It was, you know, over 60 possessions. It was, let's see, 25, 18, 21. Yeah, it was 64 possessions. That's, nobody's going to sneeze at that. I mean, it's, you know, Ohio State was averaging 83 possessions before their Notre Dame game that, again, we're going to talk about. But that was, like, super high. So, 64, I don't know. Shot clock's 80 seconds. Yeah. It's a 60-minute game. It's not that slow. And then the other thing is what it means for Syracuse. They're 2-4. I don't know, man. They got Stony Brook coming up next. They're going to have to win these next two. And then they've got Duke and Notre Dame. And I feel like their season's going to be defined by that. You know, if they go 4-0 over the course of the next four games, get back to 6-4, they have a real shot at the postseason. If they go 2-2 or worse, I don't know.
Yeah, I will say if they go 3-1, there's a high chance that they won't be able to make it because, which I will start talking and becoming a theme of it, the ACC is crumbling before our very eyes. You know, I think I drew the analogy of Syracuse Hopkins to tried and true blue blood programs playing a game is like watching your parents struggle through tax season. And whatever's happening to the ACC is 3 times that, 10 times that even. So I'm calling it that the Ivy's going to have, you know, the ACC is not going to be able to rely at their at-larges to sneak in 4 or 5 teams. The Big Ten, the Ivies are going to steal those. And I think that barring any big changes, you know, Syracuse, Duke, Notre Dame could very well be on the outside looking in. I'd say that that's more likely than not to happen.
Not all three of them. I don't think it's possible that all three of them.
No,
because they have to play each other.
Two of those three.
Like, yes.
We're not just assuming. It's not a foregone conclusion that all the ACC teams are going to be able to tap dance their way into the playoffs.
Correct. Well, let's talk about the Ivy League. Penn 8, Villanova 7.
Oh, wow.
Dylan Gurgar. 0.5 seconds left to play. Penn has now scored with 2 seconds left, 1 second left, and a 0.5 second left in their last three games. Is being clutch a skill?
No, it's not. It just means that you are playing some just interesting games. Sometimes, like, you know, you roll the dice enough, you're going to roll 3 2s in a row. You know, it's why you want to maybe throw a little money on the 4s every now and a while, maybe a hard 6 and craps. And if it hits three times in a row, then congrats, entertainment, but it's so not likely. I think one of the big fallacies that a lot of people make is when you win close games during the regular season, that means that you have experience in close games, and that bodes well for the postseason. I beg to differ, and I would actually disagree. I think it's more important that you can show that you can maintain a lead or that you can stage a comeback. So, you know, it is really interesting that it's 2-1 and half a second in the last three games. And I'm sure the boys are buzzing and they're probably getting a little team of destiny. If I'm a coach, I probably need a cigarette and a game plan on how to make sure that we're not playing such a close game. But overall, that was the take that I wanted to get out there, is close games does not mean it's a skill. I think that that's something that the general public really overanalyzes and thinks that it's more important than it is. What's your take on it?
I honestly love that take so much that I don't want to say anything else, because I think I probably would have said that winning close games was a skill, but you convinced me otherwise.
Good. And that's what I'm here to do, is tell you that everything that you think is wrong. Oh, but I will say, I mean, it just makes – I love a close game. I kind of sounded like an old curmudgeon right there. And, you know, maybe that's the theme of the day, is Nick's just an old, you know, pouty grandpa. But God, it's been that, – that was an unbelievable, like, the pole running up the field. Almost like the Seals game. 8 seconds left. Here comes a pole. Just everybody on the edge of their seats. I think those are some of the best moments in, you know, in lacrosse, whether it works out or not. More often than not, it doesn't work out. But I was still watching that highlight, just going, you know, shaking like, oh, here we go. So, good job.
It was awesome. There's no question about it. I mean, yeah, and that's why we watch sports, because they're fun and dramatic and unscripted. But at the same time, if you're a fan of a team and you want to see them win, the repeatability of what Penn is doing right now is, I mean, and they're literally like on an infinite curve toward, I mean, when you say the boys are buzzing, I think they want to know whether or not they can score with 2.5 tenths of a second left, or, you know, 25 one-hundredths of a second remaining.
Yeah, you divide by two, how close do you get to zero?
Exactly. It's just... All right. Nerd. Loyola 12, Duke 10. The Greyhounds jumped out to a 10-2 lead in the first half. I think it was in the first half. Might have scored their 10th goal after halftime. But in any case, the Blue Devils staged a comeback, as they have done numerous times, including in their losses. My colleague Patrick McEwen pointed out how similar this game was to their game against Jacksonville, and he used what I thought was like a really funny, interesting, and apropos term to describe his frustration with them, which was fascinatingly infuriating. Point being that they only play hard when their back is against the wall. What are your thoughts?
I very much agree with that. And it's why I think that, you know, granted their losses are to what? Jacksonville, Penn, and Loyola. That's not good, but holy moly, like, they go down 10-2. And, you know, there were rumblings in our group chats and whatnot, just going like, I wonder when Duke's going to turn it on, remember that they're Duke, and then just stomp everybody. And if I recall, this has been a theme, like, even, you know, the Vermont game, I was like, oh, you know, Vermont has Tommy Burke, you know, here comes a major upset alert. And then Duke's halftime speech was, hey, we're Duke, let's just stomp them. So I gotta say, like, I think Duke is a terrifyingly dangerous team, which I know is a very safe take, but at some point, I just historically, and given the talent and given the coaching staff, think that they're going to wake up and turn on the Jets. And yes, it's the, oh, Duke loses in February and then they make a big run. But I just think this team is too talented. They're going to get together. There's what I think is going to happen is they're going to have one night where they ask Coach Danowski, like, do you mind if we don't have anything on Sunday? Because the boys need some team bonding to decide to turn this season around. not even that it needs to be turned around. They've lost three times. But I was talking about this with Mike Reese, the DU poll who knocked me out of the playoffs. And I think the reason that that was the championship, Notre Dame and DU, is talking to other teams that were in the playoff, they were wound so tight that it ended up being, you know, working against them. So if I'm Duke, I'm immediately canceling practice for 2 days. Boys, go and do whatever you need to do. We're a family-friendly podcast, so I'm not going to go into the details of that, but maybe a little beer pong, maybe a little cornhole. We'll see what happens. And when this Duke team decides to wake up, I think they are going to stomp everybody in their path. And I think they're the scariest, I still, besides Virginia, like top three scariest team in college lacrosse. I think it's like, you know, Duke or Virginia, Maryland, Duke. Because these roaring comebacks, I think, say more than the fact that they go down 10-2 to start a game.
So on the other hand, the Greyhounds salvaged their season. They were 1-4 coming in with their lone victory over Lafayette. And what's fascinating is this was a team that was an overtime goal to Duke away from the Final Four last year. They returned basically everybody except for one short stick D Mitty, and they got run off the field against Maryland, lost by a goal to Rutgers and Hopkins, and lost by three to Towson. That's not the team that made it. I mean, now granted, you know, they had a harrowing survival against Denver and then lost in overtime in their next game, right? So, like, I understand that in a four-round tournament, when you only have to win twice in order to make it to the Final Four, we're not talking about, you know, going from a round of 64 to the Final Four. But still, this is not what we expected from this team coming in. And my question for you is, playing college lacrosse is so taxing that when you're doing it in your fifth or sixth year, and I think I've already asked you this once before, but I want to hear the answer again, particularly in the context of these Greyhounds. Do you wonder if there's just a little too much fatigue, residual fatigue, not like not acute fatigue, but just like, man, I can't believe I'm doing this again.
Yeah.
Is it possible that that's the explanation for why they're struggling a little bit? Or is it more fair to just say they've lost 2-1 goal games to top 20 teams in Rutgers and Hopkins, and if they had won those games, we'd be talking about them completely differently?
No, you're spot on with the – there is fatigue. And I remember reading somewhere, like, when, like, babies and children cry over spilt milk, you have to realize that that's the worst thing that's ever happened in their life. Like, literally the worst thing. And if we take that logic and apply it to college across, you know, these young adults and some children have not ever been fired. They haven't had a divorce. They haven't had, you know, family lot. Like, I even remember in college, I was like, this sucks. Why does it suck? Because my classes are hard and we have practice that's hard sometimes. I had no idea how good I had it. So it's almost like that's part of the beauty of college sports is you work so hard and you lack perspective that you are allowed to bitch a little bit and grow up a little bit and realize that not everything's sunshine and rainbows. And I recall telling you this story, and it's worth telling again, but when we lost to Duke in the national championship, that was the end of my world. You know, I had one more crack at it as a senior, but I was, you know, down in the dumps. There were seniors on that team that were walking off borderline unfazed. And, you know, these were seniors that just shoveled 4 years of Division I lacrosse shit to not crack the roster, to not be in, you know, big time recruits that didn't end up seeing much of a lick of playing time, let alone any playing time. And they worked as hard, if not harder, than anyone on the team. And I remember I was like, guys, like, how are you like not sad? And they were like, I never have to play lacrosse again. And it's what I tell kids when I, you know, D1 sports is the opportunity of a lifetime. It's also hard as shit. So I do think, like, if I were to do a fifth year and it wasn't football and I was just right back into the lacrosse mix, I think I would have done great because I just had that mindset that this was what I did and how I did it and this and that. But I know guys who are really good at lacrosse, who are grinders, who are working on Wall Street, who aren't afraid to work, that just got burnt out by the, you know, you just get beat down. So I will err much more on the side of, listen, you have a fifth year heavy team. Yes, you have the experience, but also those guys are, you know, those guys have been put through the ringer for years versus the, oh, we can just chalk it up to a couple one goal losses.
Well, they've also been as close to a quote-unquote season death as you can possibly be. I mean, when their game, their Patriot League championship game against Lehigh got canceled last year, I know firsthand that a number of those guys had no confidence that they were going to get an at-large bid to the bird, to the tournament. And so when you go through that experience, it's kind of like alligator blood.
Yeah. Do you think that change? Do you think the at-large bid conversations change in college locker rooms with what I will call the collapse of the ACC?
Yes, but I feel like it's still too early. It's kind of the theme of my column. My top 20 for this week is just that I think eight teams that I had ranked in the top 20 lost this week. So basically half of the best teams are going to practice this week with blood in their mouth. And they all have to know that everything's right in front of them, with the possible exception of Syracuse. So, yeah, I mean, but even Syracuse, Notre Dame, and Duke, who can be very disappointed in the way that their seasons have started so far, have to know that, whatever, if we reel off seven wins in a row, we're going to be just fine.
Yeah, I think it would change because, I mean, again, like, the insight that Corrigan might not love, but, you know, the locker room, we lose to Duke in the middle of our ACC run, or we lose to whoever, it's kind of like, eh, well, shit, you know, we got playoffs anyways. So, you know, let's battle for that seed, I guess, but let's just be healthy and make sure we're taking care of our bodies. Now, like, you know, these teams are good. These locker room dynamics, these conversations might be shifting. So I just think that's something interesting worth calling out.
Ohio State 14, Notre Dame 11.
I know.
This is a really interesting game. You know, my take, and I wrote the game story, I watched the whole thing pretty closely, was they just need to be like, Notre Dame needs to be 20% better in all three phases of the game, offensively, defensively, and special teams facing off. You know, I felt vindicated with Will Lynch going 4-for-6 in the first quarter against Justin Osio. It was like, this is what I was talking about on the podcast last week. It's his organic improvement as a freshman. He took all 28 faceoffs in the game. The difference was that Ohio State ran out Drew Blanchard, and that matchup seemed to favor the Buckeyes a little bit more. And then they made a similar decision in goal when they replaced Caden Johnson, who had made three saves and let three goals in the first quarter, with Skylar Walland, who made four saves in the second, but finished with seven. However, he definitely accounted for probably like two or three, maybe even four additional plays. Now, whether those were possession savers or caused turnovers or whatever the case may be, you know, backing up a shot out of bounds, whatever. He played really well. And then at the other end of the field, you know, Jack Myers, I think he had 4 and 3, really illustrated a lot of versatility, was able to attack Bobby Van Buren, or I'm sorry, able to attack Arden Cohen straight up, was able to attack when he would get switched onto short sticks. He scored an empty net goal. He threw assists in a variety of ways. You know, I really felt like that defensively, it was the slide decisions on when to go and when not to go to their short sticks that probably had an outsized effect on why Ohio State got to 14 instead of a more acceptable number like 11 or 10. So that would represent the 20% improvement that I'm talking about at that end of the field. And then offensively, they didn't get much out of Griffin Westland, who started in the lefty attack spot. Chris Kavanaugh only scored a goal, so Ohio State did a nice job limiting him. Pat Kavanaugh had 2 and 1. He had the first goal of the game. And then he was largely held quiet until, you know, basically Notre Dame was put in a similar situation to what they had been in against Maryland and Georgetown, from the standpoint of they were, you know, trailing by a handful of goals and had to really press. And, you know, he had a nice righty take down the alley when he got a speed dodge separation from Van Buren. But aside from that, I mean, this is a team that clearly is going to rely on more offensive production from their attack than they got on Saturday. And so as a result, you know, like I said, 20% improvement in each of the three phases of the game, and they're going to be fine. You know, at the other end, if you're Ohio State, you bounce back, and your bounce back ability after exceeding expectations for the first four games of the season is really, really important. And I don't even think they got humbled by Cornell. I think they just lost on the basis of game flow. You know, they basically outplayed them in two quarters. They got outplayed in two quarters, and in those two quarters, they gave up a couple more goals than they did in the quarters when they outplayed Cornell. So it wasn't like they needed to reinvent the wheel. They just needed to play marginally better, have the game go their way a little bit. And in this game, the most significant way in which things seemed to have broken toward the Buckeyes is they got awarded a buzzer-beating goal at the end of the fourth quarter, or I'm sorry, the third quarter, that based on the broadcast looked like it was after the clock had hit double zero before it left Jackson Reed's stick. But aside from that, I mean, that's my take on the game. You know, Ohio State, they're going to be seventh in my poll on Monday morning, and I think that's deserving. I think that's a really good spot for them. And then equivalently, like, Notre Dame is going to be like 14th. They just need to get, I don't think they need to go all the way back to the drawing board. I think they just need to get 20% better in every phase.
First off, great analysis. Shut up about all the Notre Dame criticism. You're biased. You're anti-Notre Dame. All that good stuff that Notre Dame fans are known for. So I just have to start everything with that. Second, I think the thing that's frustrating me when I watch this team is, you called on it earlier, is slide decisions. I don't know what their defense looks like. I only know the Jerry Byrne method. Second time I've referenced them on this podcast, and without giving him too much of a shout out or too much clout, no clout, you know, there's no such thing as free clout on this podcast. But, you know, I'm starting to wonder if it's, you know, the absence of Jerry Byrne as far, you know, in specific relation to sliding decisions. Because that was something that he hammered, and even Corrigan to an example, which makes this, you know, almost less of a solid take. But that was when we were watching defensive film, 80% of it was scouting the other team, blah, blah, blah. And the other pillar of that 80% was slide decisions. Don't give up rollbacks. Know what's a threat. Know what's a real threat to shoot, and know what's a threat to skip pass. Know who's doing a hitch out of ball movement on an approach. Know what you need to do when you slide. And it just seems like, you know, when I'm coaching little kids, I kind of call them vulnerable moments for the defense. Like, when you slide and recover, that's a vulnerable moment, is how I describe it to fourth graders. But when you go to college, you know, you need to know who you're sliding to, who is on ball, who are the backside guys, who are the step down threats if there's a skip pass, who are the dodging threats when there is skip pass. And it just seems like there's a little bit of a lapse in that, we'll call it game preparation, call it decision making, things like that. That is the thing that has me more worried. I think everything else is fixable. I'd like to see a little more true initiation and less reliance, almost in like a Syracuse way, where it's like, okay, I'm kind of seeing some one-on-one dodging. We look good on offense and then we don't. I think we can clear a lot of that up. But it's the slide decision that I keep going back to. And I'm like, you know what? I know I have a completely biased view and it's really easy to play sideline crease man, but man, like, that was not a threat. Or man, like, you need to go and get on his hands, because that was a very easy skip pass for them. So that's the one thing that I have incredibly worried. But to your point, I'm watching this game and I'm like, if we play better in a 5-minute stretch, it's a completely different game. If we just play a little bit more consistently, if we raise the floor of this team, I'm not ready to hit the panic button. Call me stupid, but I'm not ready to do it. So that's my stupid, shitty, biased take. But to see them have the worst record in the ACC, man, that's just a kick to the nuts, Terry, is what that is.
Well, let's take the opportunity for the very natural segue that you just laid out, which is Harvard 14, Michigan 9. The Wolverines came in averaging 18.43 goals per game. It was number one in Division One in their 7-0 start. They were coming off their stiffest test of the season against Delaware, whom they dispatched with relative ease after struggling through half of the first quarter or so. And this was just an incredible outing from the Crimson defense. They got 11 saves from Kyle Mullen, and I feel like you know, I didn't watch this game as intently because it was on at the same time as Ohio State and Notre Dame, and I haven't had an opportunity to rewatch it. But to the extent that I saw it, I was like, these didn't look like outrageous saves. These looked like the saves that Jerry wants to give up. He's the saves that he expects, the shots that they want to give up. And, you know, so I wrote about this like a week ago. I was like, in the shot clock era, you know, it used to be that if you held a team to fewer than 10 goals, that was a great defensive outing. And if you scored more than 12 goals, that was good offensive outing. And I don't know how those numbers are recalibrated for the 80-second shot clock. All that being said, you know, when you win 14-9, both ends of the field deserve credit. George Loring had 2 goals and 5 assists. That was an outlier performance relative to his production. Now, granted, Harvard players have basically not played lacrosse in the last 2 years or 3 years, so I don't know that we're really in a position to make sweeping judgments over any player's production, but there's no question that he, I mean, he had a hand in 50% of their goals. It was an incredible showing from Nick Loring. But again, when you hold a team to fewer than 50% of their average goal total coming in, you gotta be proud of that. And it wasn't a goalie making 20 saves. It was a goalie making 11 saves, so he was at 55%. And it was a defense that just turned a lot of Dodgers back and didn't give up many, if any, easy goals. And I talked to Jerry after the game, and he pointed to a couple things. And basically what he was saying is, we're seeing this come together. We're seeing what we want them to do, what we've been telling them to do, come together. And he pointed to a few examples. Number one, not letting Michigan Dodgers get into the middle of the field. He said that, you know, based on what they saw in film, it looked like Josh Wada, Mike Bame, whomever, were getting to the middle of the field, Jake Bonomi, if not at will, then pretty much whenever they wanted. In addition to that, he felt like they were sending slides, they were sending support from positions that Michigan players didn't expect. And whether it was because of what Harvard had put on film in their prior three games, or if it was what Harvard was doing relative to what Michigan's prior seven opponents were doing, I don't know. But, you know, he added a few more factors, but those were the first two that he listed. And so as a result, it seems like those were probably the most prominent. But ultimately, neither of those things matter if you aren't on a pretty high percentage basis, just matching feet and making it so that an offensive player isn't getting to the spot on the field where he wants to get, or isn't doing so unencumbered. And for Harvard to be playing so many young guys and to be able to limit the production of guys who've been so prolific through their first seven games is pretty incredible.
Yeah, and I think it's in stark contrast to what I was just mentioning about Notre Dame, insofar as the preparation and knowing more about the matchup than about your defensive principles. Like, yes, don't get beat to the middle of the field, but how do you do that versus, you know, for argument's sake, we'll call it, you know, a UNC guy, we'll say like Chad Tutten versus someone else. It's like, well, you have to know like all of their tendencies to know that. And it seems like that's what Harvard did a phenomenal job of, and I'm not surprised. My favorite quote maybe ever from Jerry Byrne was, actually no, scrap that because there's a million better than this, but one that stuck out to me coaching was, the best compliment we can get as a defensive unit is if the other coach at the end of the game in their press conference says, you know, they didn't really play an incredible game defensively, we just couldn't figure out a way to get into our rhythm. It's like, well, you know, you're not going to see them throwing, you know, the over the head, the around the world, the kayak checks, but just taking away what they've gone back to the well to is the best way, you know, to have a good defensive stand. So I think that's what Harvard did a phenomenal job of. And if I'm a team, you almost have to play the chess match of, okay, they know what we're going to do. Now we need to just fine tune it a little bit so that when we run out of that play that we've been running, or that, you know, our tendencies, we need to get comfortable experimenting with some other things that might catch them off guard. And, you know, Michigan has been beating the brakes off of everybody. So who knows how much of it is Michigan was playing inferior opponents and this is their first time they saw a challenge. It was versus how good Harvard's prep was. Yeah. But also, what is going on with college kids being able to casually throw around the worlds? When did that start happening? And thank God I'm out of college now, because I could not hang stick skill wise with any of these guys. What the hell?
Are you kidding
me?
I saw on Twitter this week you dive across the front of the crease and throw an around the world goal.
Yeah, against nobody. And that took 100% of my talent and skill and athleticism. I was like, oh, we're just going to go do a funny video. That was as hard as I could have tried. Like, that was the creme de la creme of my talent. If I tried to do that game, not only would I get benched, but I probably would have been taken out back to where the horses meet after they break their legs.
Friday night, a game that was the game of the weekend, but due to all the rescheduling as a result of the bomb cyclone that hit the East Coast, feels like it happened in week four. Princeton 16, Rutgers 11. To the earlier point about how do you know which end of the field deserves more credit, when your team gets a 16, the offense deserves a lot of credit. And two guys, Alex Slusher and Coulter McAsee, put up 4 goals and 2 assists. One of those guys, Alex Slusher, that's kind of become par for the course for. He had 5 in Princeton's win over Georgetown. The other had a breakout performance. Coulter McAsee had one of the highlights of the year, a 2 change of direction spin move from the righty wing that got compared to Shamel Bratton. I mean, who saw that coming?
No, I mean, are you asking me?
No. It was rhetorical.
Because nobody. Holy moly. And this is what's a little bit scary about the Ivy Leagues. It's like, okay, if you were to rank the Ivy Leagues right now, the Ivy League teams, who are your top 3?
Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
Penn and Yale. I'm going to have 6 Ivy League teams in my top 20 on Monday.
And I don't necessarily disagree with that, but the fact that Princeton, who is nasty, is not in that top 3.
I mean,
is,
they are. Is, like resume-wise, they are. They're number 3. But my point, I'm basing it more on from a, you know, and this is the, I chirped you about this either last week or 2 weeks ago, but like, I look at this through like a 5-year lens, and Princeton has been the team since Bill Tierney left that their high-end talent was always able to play with everybody. It was guys 8 through 17 that fell off. And when I've watched Princeton so far this season, and there's still a lot of season left to play, I don't see a ton of weaknesses anywhere on the field, including from a depth standpoint. You know, if they bring in a 4th attackman, if they're running their 2nd midfielders, their 3rd and 4th short sticks, their 4th defenseman. I mean, I think they have incredible goalie depth. So Princeton is very, very good. But at the same time, if you're asking me who's going to win the Ivy League championship, I'm going to take one of those 3 teams ahead of them.
I mean, so here's what we were arguing about. And because you know more than me, which I hate to admit, about this topic, not about anything else, how does the Ivy League go from we are the most sensitive to COVID, so we're not having a season, and it's like fire sale, every player goes everywhere, and then only a year later, now all of a sudden they have depth coming out the wazoo? How does that work? Like, what's your thesis on that? Because whatever yours is, I'm just going to copy it in conversation.
They'd been recruiting incredibly well in 2018 and 19. I think that it's going to be interesting to see how this continues to develop in classes into the future, because so everyone talked about how the mid-majors benefited from early recruiting because all the ACC programs would go super early on kids that didn't develop, early bloomers, and leave all the late bloomers to the mid-majors. And that was what they were winning their national championships on or whatever. And so when the rules changed with, you know, a little bit the class of 2018, a little more class of 2019, you know, predominantly, you know, 125 guys had committed in the class of 2020 before the rules changed. So, you know, it was really 21 where I think 5 or 6 guys had committed before the rules changed that actually was like a blank slate. So, you know, if we're talking about juniors and seniors, we're talking about, you know, high school class of 2018 and 19. And the Ivy League programs just did a really good job in those classes. And how valuable is the opposite of what we talked about when we were talking about the residual fatigue of playing 5 years? Meaning, if you miss two seasons, number one, how fresh are you physically? And number two, how bad do you want it because of how much it's been taken away from you? So is it possible that that's a contributing factor here? It's definitely possible. I guess, is it likely?
I think so. And I think that, like, if you had a straight run of 5 years in a row, that's crazy. And this is where my experience and workshopping what I would have done in that scenario is borderline non-applicable. Because if I'm an Ivy League player and I'm a junior and my season gets canceled, the last thing I'm doing is staying in shape. I am pretty much attaching a beer bong to the wall. I'm uploading Call of Duty.
I thought you were going to say attaching it to your, you know, femoral artery.
Yeah, you know, probably. That makes a lot more sense. But, you know, I would have gone nuts, though, and I would have showed up. And this was a problem that I always had. Little funny insight. Corrigan, every single January, Nick, how was your winter workouts? And I'm like, really good. Okay, so why are you fat and out of shape? I don't know. Must be something in the air today. Like, I never
bad workout plan, coach. Up with
it. Yeah. I don't know. The curls didn't exactly get me in shape. But I think that if you have your season taken away from you, then that gives you more motivation to come back because you know that it's going to be there. Like, yes, the world went to shit, but for those players that can figure out a way to stay motivated and, like, actually come back, that's when you get the fights in practice because everybody's so fired up to be back. You know, there's always two types of fights in practice. One, fatigue fights, two, excited fights. I love the good fatigue fight. Every practice fight I ever got in was usually late April to early mid May. I've seen you guys too often and I want to get away from you and I'll punch you in the face to do so. But I think that there's something to be said for an unprecedented pandemic taking away some of these seniors or, you know, even any players' right to play. And so it gives them a little more appreciation and perspective. And just like I was, you know, drawing on earlier, you can get fatigued because you don't realize how good you had it. You know, like, oh, I was bitching about workouts. Really? That was tough in my life. These players very likely have that perspective now. And they have that, you know, they have almost that stress test of, I know what life is like when there's nothing to do. And my God, would I rather have a miserable workout than sitting on the couch for another goddamn day? So any number of ways you can take it, but I think that that's probably a good explanation for what's happening for the Ivies now that I think about it for about 5 seconds.
I'll accept it, but we're running out of time.
But now I'm playing two sides of the same fence, you know?
I know, but when faced with different evidence, you can come to different conclusions.
Yeah, I'll think about it and then have like my hard, here's where I stand afterwards. Maybe
you should
next
talk
week
to some of your Ivy League alum friends and hear what they.
Yeah,
doing.
But I
hearing
hate him. Oh yeah, let me reach out to TD. He went to TD. What's going on at Albany, DU, Yale, and Syracuse? Maybe he just gives us insight into all four.
Exactly. All right, couple quick ones. UMBC 13, Utah 10. The Utes coming off of a big W in Jacksonville a week ago Sunday, fall short to the Retrievers in Catonsville on Friday night.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to put anyone on blast, and I'm not one to point fingers or to draw storylines from very small anecdotal evidence. This Utah team did not respect the UMBC team. There's a specific intern at the post game. He's going to go unnamed, but Drew Wasserman was like, UMBC sucks, hammer Utah, money line, blah, 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 blah. You know, and by the way, we use that no matter what. We don't gamble on games, but we use that to describe what's happening. So NCAA, relax. We're not actually gambling on this. But, you know, I think this is just a classic case of team gets a little bit too excited about what they've done, underestimate an opponent. And just disappointing. We wanted to have Utah be a little bit of a wagon this year, selfishly. And I think that this game is one of the more disappointing losses for an up-and-coming program. Like, I don't think Vermont or even Jacksonville are kind of like those, oh, we're competing with the big dogs. I don't think anything takes the wind out of this sails of a program like this UMBC loss has done or will do to Utah. And I'd love to be proven wrong on that.
And finally, Virginia 15, North Carolina 11. Thursday Night Lacrosse is back. This was a game of runs. Virginia scored the first two. Carolina responded to go up 5-2. Virginia responded to make it 7-5. Carolina took a 10-9 lead into halftime. The Cavaliers scored, I believe, the next five straight. And then Carolina never mounted that last comeback. The aspect of this that I found most interesting was Cade Sostad was injured in Virginia's win over Johns Hopkins the prior weekend. So we saw Cole Kastner, who had had 19 caused turnovers in five games, change roles to now, instead of being that Brody Merrill backside double, covering the number one for the opponent. And Chris Gray had a goal and three assists. A completely acceptable outcome for a guy who came in averaging better than 7 points per game. And, you know, again, like, Virginia, in my opinion, won because they scored 15 goals. But on the other hand, you hold Carolina to 11 and you, I think, hold them to one goal in the last 30 minutes. You can argue pretty well that you won that game because of your defense. So kudos to Kastner. Kudos to the Cavaliers. And it sets up a really tasty number one versus number two matchup, Virginia Maryland at Audi Field on Saturday. Nick, what do you got?
I only have one take. You already know it. Number 32 on Virginia, borderline my public enemy number one. You crack a dude in the back, you flop like the most egregious soccer player I've ever seen in my life, and then get up like you're about to swing on someone. I don't inherently have a problem with flopping, but you have to stick with that. Yes, flop. I understand that Baptiste made me respect it because every time I tried to muck him up, he would flop. I would get a penalty. Okay, I understand the value of it. But Baptiste stayed with it. He didn't get up after flopping and act like he was going to beat me up. So stick with one, pick one. But for you to show both sides as clearly as you did, not that I'm ever going to talk shit about a college kid. I'm above that. But that was one of the most egregious things I've ever seen in my life. I could not let this game go by without mentioning an end rant.
Did you see the clip? Kevin Brown posted it. So Maryland against Albany moved their game inside. They played it in Cole Fieldhouse. And it started at 10 a.m. And the facility is not wired to live stream a game. So they had somebody basically stream it from their cell phone, and he tried to get from like one position on the balcony overlooking the field to another, and the security guard wouldn't let him through.
Yes. What an
unbelievable
loser.
Hardo outfit.
I mean, the Hardo of the week goes to that guy. Like, no, I can't let you. And the dude's like, dude, like literally I'm just trying to stream. Like it's a stream. And then you said it best, like the audacity of people to be like, oh, what isn't this stream? It's like, shut up. Like, do you know how hard it is logistically? And that's something that, like, this broadcasting job has showed me. For the NLL to have as good of a product as it does, the amount of work that goes into that, cameras, producers, audio techs, you know, obviously the smokes that are on camera in San
Diego,
not the play-by-play guy, though. Makeup, extra makeup, maybe a little snack for the fat boy in the booth. I don't know. You know, let's get crazy.
Craft service, baby.
The amount of work that goes into it. So, like, for them to prevent, like, the one guy that's just trying to do it all, it's like that gif of the person washing the car and he's fumbling, like, five different things and falling over. It's like, nope, not today. It's like, all right, well, your wife probably makes your life miserable. Congrats on having a little power. hit the showers and take a lap after a job well done of being a hard-o loser.
I am going to enjoy the analogy of thinking that your parents are invincible and then watching them do taxes for the first time. That's, I can't even remember what you compared it to. Did you compare it to Hopkins or Syracuse's offense?
Notre I compared defense? It to Syracuse Hopkins.
Yeah.
It's just sad.
Oh, it was like, Hopkins.
Oh, hey,
clearing.
Mom, Dad, I accidentally threw
Oh, it was
up.
Just the game. It was the
yeah,
game.
It was Hopkins Q's.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you walk down and there's papers all over the dining room table. Both their hands are in their head. And this isn't even speaking from experience either. Like I knew what the hell. I still don't know what taxes are. But I just thought it was a funny – it was the dumbest thing I could think of off the top of my head.
Well, kudos to you. Can't wait for 4 weeks from now when I – well, I guess 31 days from now when I remind you that it's April 13th and your taxes are due in 2 days.
Oh, man. My favorite day of the year.
Nick Acello, it's been the Tailgate Podcast. As always, thank you for joining. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. We're going to be talking about number one versus number two.
Thank you. Love you, Terry.
Love you, Nick. Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Acello. Welcome to the Tailgate.